Thanks for everyone who decided to not start Thanksgiving break early. So last time we were talking about page tables, and we talked about page tables primarily as a way that we would provide the illusion of a dedicated memory, that we would translate program addresses with this table into these real addresses. And the natural thing to think is that if something is invalid in the table and not accessible, that it just doesn't exist in the program's address space. And we know that when we run programs, we have these big holes, these big places where we just can't access stuff. And when you access it, you expect a segmentation fault to happen, which, as we discussed, is the OS gets to run, it decides what to do, and it reflects that back to your process, usually by terminating. But the OS, as we mentioned at the end of last time, doesn't need to crash in that case. When the processor finds out the page table entry is invalid and notifies the OS, hey, you were trying to run this thing, but I found an invalid page table, the OS can instead take corrective action. It can decide, I'm going to change these page tables to make this memory access that just gave me a fault work, and then I'm going to retry it, rerun the program from that point. And this is a very common thing, and it enables us to do lots of things which aren't really possible with real memory. So I'll start with a simple example, talking about allocating space on demand. So when we draw our picture of what a program looks like, we have the stack. And usually we sort of think of when we're writing a program, we have tons of stack space. We can put megabytes of stuff in the stack. But most programs don't do that. You know, usually we're like using like 12 kilobytes of the stack or something like that, which would be on my laptop, 3 pages worth. But yeah, because some programs, or sometimes we might use megabytes of space, often we'll have logically allocated to the stack many megabytes of space. And if we did the natural thing and just set up our page table so there was a physical page for each of these parts of the stack, that seems pretty wasteful. And it'd be nice if we could avoid doing that. And in practice, operating systems do. They don't actually allocate all this huge amounts of wasted space, these extra hundreds of pages of the stack that most of the time you don't have that much deep recursion. You don't have these big arrays you put allocated in functions as a local variable. You don't need that much space. So what this means is you're running a program and you have some instruction which requires more stack space, like a push. And our program is running, push is going to go access a page table entry, which, because we're going to decrement the stack pointer, points to an invalid page. The OS just doesn't allocate all the stack space that you think you have. So you have this push, which is trying to go beyond the end of the allocated space you have. And what the easiest thing for the OS to do would just be to crash your program. Just say, sorry, you ran out of space. That was invalid. I don't know what to do. But the OS can be smarter than that. Instead, it can say, oh, you were trying to allocate to access something just beyond the end of your stack. I know what you went to do. I know you wanted to push something on the stack, and I need to give you a little more space to do that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a page full. I'm going to look at that page and say, OK, it's invalid. So I can fix that. I can make it valid. So I'm going to choose as the OS a physical page to assign to you. So I'm going to somehow decide that this is some physical memory I have free that I can give to you. I'm going to allocate it as your stack space and restart that instruction, that push instruction that we tried to run before and just failed. And retry it and run your program as usual. And all you'll notice is that your program runs this push instruction a little slow, because we actually had to run this OS routine, which allocated the whole page. Maybe you had to initialize that page to zeros. But as far as you're concerned, you just tried to run a push instruction and it ran a little slow, but it ran and produced the correct result. But the gain you get is that now your programs that mostly don't use megabytes of stack space don't need to allocate megabytes of stack space just in space. The OS just allocates as you use more stack space. And this can be applied not just to the stack, but to every other part of our program memory. We can allocate that all on demand. So we can just set up an empty page table when we start a program and try to run the first instruction. It's going to fail. It's going to say, oh, there's no, that's an invalid page you're trying to execute. And we can just load that and then try again and keep doing it until it works. So this is a valid and kind of real implementation strategy for OSs. You just create an empty page table to load a program. And as the program actually accesses things, then you start allocating the physical memory and setting up the page table for it. So obviously, this is not the most efficient thing because it means you're executing OS code every instruction for the first couple times. So probably you want to do some sort of compromise where you do this sometimes, but you like load the stuff you know you definitely need in advance. And there's lots of choices in operating systems, but they usually do some form of this allocate stuff on demand, both for things like stack space, where it starts out empty, and for things like a file that's your executable, they'll just only load it as you start using it. And this allows them to start programs faster than they could otherwise. And allows them to save space if you just say, don't execute large parts of your executable in a typical run, which is good for things like LS, where you know, you might not use some of the options in LS, and it would be nice if we didn't have to load them and therefore spend more time starting LS and make your command line slower. And there are so more things we can do with this. We'll talk about at least a couple more. And the general idea is that we're going to deliberately make the program trigger a page or a protection fault, trigger these faults that we said the program was doing something wrong, but not because the program's doing anything wrong. So this is not going to be a fault where the program actually did something wrong. We're just going to simulate the functionality that was supposed to happen, what the program was trying to do. And the same sort of idea I talked about VMs doing, we're going to emulate what the instruction should do, mostly by fixing it so it will work and then retrying it. And this means that the page table is not the OS's data structure for keeping track of what a program's memory is. Because it needs to know how to do these things. If it wants to load something on demand, all it sees is there's an invalid page table entry. It needs some other data structure that it's going to have for every program, which says, oh, this part of memory is the stack. Because that's not in the page table, because the hardware doesn't know. All the hardware sees is that that's invalid memory. So the page table is not what defines what your program is, the OS does. The page table is how the OS tells the hardware what your program can do. But the OS actually decides because it makes changes in response to faults. So questions about this general idea? Okay, so that's our things we can do. So there's some stuff that we depend on the hardware doing to make this possible. So one thing is that it would be really handy if when we have a page fault, when there's an invalid entry in the page table we try to access, if the hardware tells us where that was. We can probably technically figure this out by, say, reading the instruction and figuring out what it does from the PC, but that's really annoying, and the hardware already needed to compute the address, so generally it's going to store it for the OS. So the fault handler is going to get the address from the hardware, which is, this is the thing I tried to access in the page table and couldn't find anything. We also need it to be the case that we can easily rerun the faulting instruction. And this is an idea known as precise exceptions. So when we have a fault from accessing an invalid page, we don't just want the processor to stop the program. We want to stop the program just before the instruction with the error. So we want no side effects for that push instruction. So the push instruction should not have implemented the stack pointer, incremented the stack pointer yet, or decremented the stack pointer, because that would mean if we rerun it, we're going to have the stack pointer at a different place. So we want it to stop as if we stop the program just before the instruction with the error. And we also probably want it to be the case for things like faults that the default thing when you return from the exception is that you return to the place to that instruction which failed. to retry it. And that's generally going to be what processors will do, is that unlike system calls where we return to the thing after the system call instruction, for things like page faults, we'll generally return to the instruction which failed to try it again, because we assume that hopefully it will work this time. So I have the example of loading on demand, and our textbook presents virtual memory in a very different way than I talked about it. So they present virtual memory as supporting a particular, what I called a page table trick, called swapping. And the idea they put about is that we're going to use the disk or SSDs or some other sort of slow storage that is more, at least slower than memory, as a part of the memory hierarchy. That the idea is that just like our L1 cache holds parts of memory temporarily, and we want to always access things in the L1 cache for speed, our DRAM is going to hold parts of our program's data temporarily, but really the real home for that data is on disk. So that's the idea of swapping, is that really the home for all data is on disk, which means we have tons and tons of space. We have many, many, many gigabytes of space on a typical modern machine, terabytes even often. And memory is just a temporary cache for that, which we want things to be in to be fast. And we're going to implement this by having the OS manage it. So the OS, when it allocates space for a program, in a system with swapping, the idea is it really is allocating space on disk, and DRAM is just a cache for that space. So all the data really lives on disk, and it just loads it from disk into memory as needed. So that's sort of the idea of swapping. And you can think of swapping as a type of caching. So it's very much like our caches. The cache block is a physical page. So just like we have a block of data in an L1 cache, we have a physical page in memory that was presumably loaded from disk at some point. It's fully associative. So this is very much unlike the caches we've talked about. And it's fully associative because we can put every virtual page, anything the program accesses, can go at any physical page. We don't have any restrictions on where we store a virtual page in physical memory. And this is because our page table, we just have a physical page number. We don't just have part of a physical page number. Replacement in this cache is managed by the operating system. So this is unlike our L1 cache. In our L1 cache, the hardware needed to handle replacement. Here, some code in the OS runs to do replacement. And so the operating system gets to choose what a replacement policy is, or even whether we're doing swapping at all. Normal cache hits, however, happen without the OS. So the fast case, the hardware takes care of looking at the page table and doing the address translation. And we definitely want this to be the case, because there's a lot of overhead in starting an exception handler to do something. There's the overhead in just like saving all the values and restoring them, which we talked about exception handlers doing. There's also overhead in that if we have an out of order or pipeline processor, we need to worry about instructions that are partway through the pipeline. We're going to lose some of those as far as the time we would have had overlapping instructions because we execute part of the OS. So if we're implementing swapping, this idea that really our pages live on disk, there are two things we want to do. So one thing is that once the program tries to access pages, we want to swap them in. We want to bring them in from this slow storage into memory. So this is exactly the same as allocating space on demand. The only difference is exactly where we get the new page to go. Either is it like, do we choose an empty page and send it to zeros, or do we copy from disk? That's the only difference. It's exactly like allocating on demand. We get a page fault, we look at the faulting address, it's invalid, we figure out, oh, it's on disk here, I'm going to load it from disk. We also need to worry about swapping out a page. So eventually, since we're imagining that we have, we went to programs to think they have as much memory as we have disk space, we're going to run out of physical pages. We're going to run out of space to keep the data the program's accessing. And so we need to move a physical page back to disk. So if it's changed, if it hasn't changed, we don't have to do that. So do this. And we need to mark it as invalid in the page tables that reference it so we can use it for a different virtual page. So we're going to load something in its place. We're going to do replacement. And in doing replacement, we need to swap in something and swap out something if we don't have just something that's blank, empty. Among our physical pages, we're using to cache things on disk. So there's a reason I didn't present virtual memory in terms of swapping first. And the biggest reason is that, well, it's not actually a particularly great idea these days. And this is mostly because hard drives and even solid state drives are slower relative to memory than they used to be. So it used to be that swapping gave you pretty good performance. This is not so much the case anymore. But it still exists very commonly, and probably largely because this allocating space on demand you basically get for free if you implement swapping. And it's something you actually want to do because it makes programs start up faster. But you don't actually want to be commonly swapping out and swapping in pages all the time because that's slow. So hard drives, so hard drive read or write is milliseconds to tens of milliseconds. In contrast to memory access, in terms of latency, is like 50 to 100 nanoseconds. So they're slow. And even SSDs, typically you're talking like hundreds of microseconds. So this is way, way, way slower. And this has some implications. So one implication is that if you're doing swapping, replacement policies really matter a lot. And you can spend a lot of time doing your replacement policy because if you save a couple milliseconds a couple times, that's a lot of time versus what you're losing. So you can spend like, if you spend like hundreds of microseconds computing your replacement policy, that's probably okay. Another thing is that in addition to this being the speed of the writes, the way HDDs and SSDs work is they like writing big chunks and reading, and to a lesser extent, reading big chunks. So they want to read kilobytes at a time. And this is the reason why our page sizes are basically the size they are. That someone, probably in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, looked at what hard drives did well and decided, okay, 4K is a reasonable size to read from a hard drive at once. And that's why that sort of size was chosen. Because this is a reasonable size to read at once that pays for this cost that you basically, if you're reading from a hard drive, if you're reading 4 kilobytes or 1 byte, it's the same amount of time. So with that caveat about the sort of the actual speed of doing this is pretty slow, even though we're doing 4K at a time and that you know you want to do it, let's look at the sort of the timeline for swapping. And we'll assume, good case here. So we have program A and program B, and program A has this entry in its page table which is marked as invalid, which I've marked with dashed lines, and it tries to access it, and it gets a page fault. And the OS, when it runs in the page fault handler, realizes, oh, I know where that's supposed to be. That's stored on disk. I've represented disk by the universal cylinder symbol, since that's kind of what disk hard drives physically look like. And it starts the read from its page fault handler. And as I said, disks typically take milliseconds to perform a read. So that read is not going to complete it right away, and the OS is not just going to spin waiting for the read. Instead, what it's typically going to do is it's going to run something else in the meanwhile. But before it does that, it needs to actually decide where is it reading into. It needs to say to the disk, hey disk, please read this page and put it here. It needs to decide where. And if we're out of space, it's going to need to evict something else. So another part of the thing it will do from the page fault handler, so we'll choose some page to replace. And hopefully, we're going to choose a page to replace that won't be used soon, and that we don't have to first write to disk. So the ideal is some page which hasn't been modified that won't be used soon. So program B, which you know, hopefully is very idle, and that's some part of its memory which is not likely to be used anytime soon. So we'll evict that, so we have space for the disk to load the data. Because presumably, if we're really doing swapping, we're actually using all of our memory. And we actually need the hard drive because we don't have enough capacity. So we mark that page as invalid and start our read. And while the read is happening, we're going to tell the disk, please read this. And the disk will get back to the operating system after a while. So in the meantime, we're going to run some other program. Hopefully some program which isn't also waiting for a page to be read from disk. And probably an unrelated program. And then an interrupt will happen. Because the disk will say, hey, I'm finished reading this. I loaded that for you. It's all ready. And at that point, the OS gets to run. And the interrupt handler can fix the page table entry and restart the program from the point of the fault. So this is the typical procedure we would imagine for handling swapping. So it could be a little worse. We could have to, instead of just discarding program B's page, we could have to ask the disk to start writing it and then wait for that to finish and then only start reading if it happened to not have changes that we needed to write back to disk. And we could not have something else to run. That would also be pretty inefficient. This is our normal case timeline for swapping. So any questions about anything on this picture? Yeah? So where are program A and program B pages stored? So they're stored ultimately in this scheme on disk. Like the last resort is on disk. Ideally, there is a cached and often more up-to-date copy in memory where they're stored. But part of this scheme is generally that every virtual page has a place where it's supposed to go on disk. Just like every block in a cache has a place where it's supposed to go in memory. It might not be the case that we ever actually update memory. So for example, with a write-back cache, we might modify something in the cache without telling memory about it. And the same thing happens here. But it has a home on the disk. Other questions? So there are two big decisions that we need to make in our implementing swapping about, which are decisions about designing caches. So one, which I just alluded to, is the write policy. So in caches, we had this decision about write through versus write back. So write through is not really an option. So we can't really implement write through because if we have a fault, so we could say, let's make the page invalid so we can forward writes to the real disk. Well, when we have a fault, the write doesn't happen because we stopped before because we are supposed to restart and retry. And the hardware, you know, isn't going to write to disk itself. It's possible to implement this, but you like have to like read the push instruction and emulate it and do the part which writes to disk. And this would make the program run really, really slow because we need to start a write to disk, run some OS code. Every time you write to memory, that would be ridiculous. So instead, we're going to do write back. So we're going to need to keep a dirty bit for every virtual page. Was this virtual page mine? And often, we're going to actually steal some space in the page table to do this. And there's two options for how we update this dirty bit. So in a cache, we said that when we write to a cache block, when it's modified, we set the dirty bit to indicate that we haven't written this back to memory. And the same idea is going to happen here. Whenever we use a page table entry to access a physical page, we're going to want to set the dirty bit in that page table entry to indicate the corresponding physical page is not up to date with what would be on disk. So there's two options for implementing this. Most commonly, this is actually implemented by hardware. So a hardware feature is that part of the address translation, when the MMU reads the page table entry, it's going to set the dirty bit for you if it's a write. It's going to modify the page table. This is the most common implementation. If you didn't have that hardware help, it's actually not too bad. You just mark the page as read-only, and you're going to get a fault. And when you get that fault, you set a bit saying it's dirty, mark it as writable, and then restart the program there. And because you're only doing this the first time the page is written, this is not actually that much overhead. And also, it's not much overhead for the hardware because it only modifies the page table entry the first time it's written. Because it doesn't need to modify it to set the dirty bit twice. The dirty bit's either set or it's not. Yes?
What if you happen to set a page back to where it was before you made that page dirty? If you don't need to rewrite the disk.
So the question is, what happens when we, say, change where a page table entry points? Or we write a page back to disk. So the OS is going to be responsible, because it handles writing pages to disk and updating the page table entries, for clearing the dirty bits when they need to be cleared. This is part of what the OS's job is going to be. So when the OS changes a page table entry, it needs to set clear the dirty bit for that page table entry, assuming it wants it to be clear. And if it's changing a page table entry to a page which is already modified, it should have the dirty bit set initially. And this is part of one of the things the OS needs to get right. So other questions about dirty bits and page table entries? Okay. So another decision we need to make is the replacement policy. And this is going to be implemented in software. It's in software because when we do replacement, when we decide what to set the page table entry to, that's the OS running. The OS decides what physical page number to put there, and therefore needs to decide where to find that physical page number, modify some other page table entry in another process to make it invalid so it has more space. And because this is in software, we can implement much, much more complex policies than we could ever imagine doing in hardware. So just like with caches, sort of our natural idea for a policy is we want to do LRU replacement, least recently used. That pages which are recently accessed, if we assume programs have locality, are likely to be accessed again soon. This isn't always true. It depends on how programs are written. But empirically, it's pretty close to the best you can do. Now, this is not practical to do exactly, because we need to actually know when our page is used. And as I said, the hardware handles the common case. The hardware is doing the translation. So if we wanted to do this, the hardware would need to keep a list of what pages did we access when, in what order, so we know which was last, which was second to last, which was third to last, as we need to find new pages to get. We could do this in software, but then we need to have a fault in every memory access so we knew it happened, which would not be very performant. So just like with hardware, we're going to approximate LRU. We're not going to implement a real LRU policy, but typically operating systems, with help from the hardware, are going to implement an approximation of LRU. And one approximation is this idea of just not recently used, that the thing I want from LRU is I don't want to replace anything that was used pretty recently, because that's likely to be a big mistake. But things that weren't used for a long time, they're probably about equally bad. That's the hope. So one way of implementing this is that the OS can just periodically mark all pages as invalid. And when a page fault happens, it just makes it accessible again and puts it on a list of used pages. Then when it needs to do replacement, it chooses a page that's not on that list of used pages. And this will at least avoid the bad case of replace something you just accessed. And if we wanted to have a tiebreaker, we can like see track of how many times was it on the used list the last few times we did this, and so on. And this sort of idea is how OSs implement their replacement policies, that they use this sort of mechanism to scan when pages are used to get an idea of which ones are used recently-ish. But not, they don't have a precise order because the hardware can't really implement that for them and can't do it in software efficiently. And just like I said, the hardware implements dirty bits, even though the OS could do it, the hardware actually helps out with this. So often, hardware has an accessed bit in the page table entry. So every time you read or write using a page table entry, the memory management unit sets this bit to 1. And so instead of the OS marking the page as invalid and adding it to a use list, it can just set the access bits to 0, and the hardware will set it to 1, and it can check what the access bits are. And just scan the list for used pages, and that's a bit more efficient. And this is pretty efficient for the MMU to do because it's just the first time we read or write the page, we set this bit, otherwise there's no more work to do. Okay, so questions about access bits in this not recently used idea? Okay. So these are kept in the page table entries themselves, almost always. You don't have to, but this is the design pretty much everyone has chosen, especially because the hardware helps out and needs to know, where do I put this data? Note that on a real program, we mentioned that like we share memory between processes. This means that there were multiple page table entries for the same physical page, the same thing on disk. And this means that the OS actually needs to take this into account. So they have each of those page table entries for the same, say, shared library, has its own valid and access bits. And when the OS wants to figure out is it recently used, it needs to check all of them, all the page table entries that refer to that physical page. But that's not too hard to do in software. So that's my incredibly brief discussion of swapping. So questions about swapping in general? And the hardware support we have for it. Okay. So I'll mention two other page table tricks, things that OSs do that make memory seem pretty magical besides swapping, that are pretty common. And relatively simple compared to swapping to implement. So one is mmap. This is the name on Unix for this. There's a which is called map memory mapping is the generic term. So on Unix, you can open a file and map it to your memory. So this is kind of like reading the file into your memory, but it's a bit different. When you modify this thing you get back from this mmap call, you get this array which represents the file quite literally. Not only when you read from it, you get the contents of the file. If the file is updated and you read from it, you see the new contents automatically. If you write to the contents, if you're allowed to do that, you change the file. And the operating system just makes this work, and it doesn't matter if other programs are accessing the file. It also doesn't matter that the file is on disk. It will get written to disk eventually. And this just works. So questions about sort of what I'm saying happens from the programmer's point of view? So this seems like pretty magical functionality, but it's basically free if you can implement swapping anyways. All we've done is we've set up some pages and we've said they map to the part on disk which holds this file. So it's, if you have the machinery to implement swapping, you get memory mapped files for free. And this can be a convenient way to do file I/O. Yeah. So if you access it for the first time, you swap it in, not from some random place on disk, but from some particular file on disk. When you need to swap it out, when you need to replace it, you check if the dirty bit's set, and if so, you write not to some random place on disk, but just into the file. And there's just a bit of an extra detail that if other programs try to read the file, you just need to make sure they're reading from the same physical pages, including inside the OS. That's pretty simple to do in the OS. You just say, do I have this file loaded in memory? And you look up what physical page number is it at. And you do that every time you handle file I/O in the operating system. And this is this sort of functionality. I've shown you what it looks like on Linux and Unix. This is implemented on every modern OS you can think of. So another common trick you can do with page tables is something called copy on write. So on Unix, the most commonly used mechanism for starting a new process is something called fork. And when you read about fork being the standard way to start a new process, it seems like a completely insane choice. So when your shell starts ls, typically what it does is it calls fork to make a copy of the entire shell program and all its memory, and then that copy replaces itself with ls. So we're making this whole copy of all of our shell just to immediately replace it with a different program. Seems very wasteful. And it seems like this would be really slow. It's not fast, but it's not nearly as slow as you would expect, because we don't actually need to make a complete copy. So one way we don't need to make a complete copy is that if I'm making a copy of my shell that's running, I can just have the same memory for the read-only stuff. The code in constants, I don't need to change anything. I can just have two page tables that refer to the same physical pages because it's read-only. Mentioned that was a thing we could do to save space sharing data. But how about this stuff? This writable data, like global variables. Can I have that be the same? And it seems kind of a shame that we need to have different copies for this, because most of it's going to stay the same. Now, most of these global variables we aren't going to touch as we're starting ls. So it seems like we don't actually need a separate copy of them. We should be able to use the same one. And this is exactly what we're going to do. For all this other memory, we're going to just have it be the same, assuming that it doesn't change. So our idea is that we're going to share writable data, and that's fine to do as long as it doesn't change. And we have a way to make sure it doesn't change, which is that we, in the page table, we say it's read-only. Sorry, you can't write it. So we just tell the CPU that all this data that we're sharing between the two programs is read-only. And of course, the program's going to try to write something, like something on the stack or something like that. But when it does, we'll get a fault. And we can say, oh, it's trying to write here. Now I'll make the copy. So instead of making a copy of everything in advance, what we're going to do is we're going to make everything read-only. And when you try to access something to write it, we're going to actually make a copy then. And we're only going to make a copy of the pages that actually change. Just like when I talked about allocating stack space on demand, we'd only allocate pages that actually were used. So the idea is that, you know, we start out, we have some writable data, we make a copy of that, and all this make a copy of our program call is doing, we're making a whole copy of our shell, is we're copying the page table and setting it read-only. So we don't actually have to copy all that, kilobytes or megabytes of memory, we just copy these page tables, which are relatively small, and just set them read-only. then one of these processes is gonna try to write to that memory we set read-only that's logically writable. That's some global variable that is changing that should only be seen in one of the processes. At that point, the OS will get a fault. It will say, oh, it's faulting on this virtual page number. Now I'm gonna make a new copy of that physical page. So I'm gonna allocate new space for it and make it writable. And we can do that every time we try to write something new. And this way, we only allocate new space for anything which actually changes and save a lot of time. So questions on this? So that's all I'm going to talk about for these page table tricks. So these things operating systems can do with page tables that are beyond just having different virtual addresses for different programs, different virtual addresses correspond to different physical addresses for programs that let us implement new functionality, like you can access a file as if it's part of your memory. So now I'm going to talk about my second topic today, which is about a problem we talked about before, which was how big page tables are. So I talked about, I have a 64-bit laptop. It seems like to store page tables, the way we've discussed doing it, because I have 4 kilobyte pages, that I need 0.5 terabyte of RAM, which does not fit in my laptop at present. So clearly that's not what we're doing. And we want to do something to save space, but we like this idea of page tables with all the nice things we can do with them. The ability to like load little parts of the program, have a very flexible layout, so we want that. But how can we save space? And the key observation we're going to use to save space, but still have these page table entries with their dirty and accessed and read-only and bits and different page numbers in each one, is we're going to observe that there's some patterns in memory that help us. And the big one is most pages in a program's memory are invalid. And we're just going to represent these big chunks of invalid pages in a more compact way. So we're not going to store most of the invalid page table entries. And to do this, we're going to use a data structure other than a flat array. So we'd like, you know, something where we look up a virtual page number, we get a page table entry. And there's lots of options for that. And those of you who did the reading saw the option we're actually choosing. So one option, which if I asked you at the beginning of this course, would probably be the one most of you would come up with, based on what we teach before, would be a hash table. And this is actually used by some processors, but it's not the most common thing to do. So it would be a valid option. We could have a hash table where instead of storing a big flat list of virtual page number, page table entries, we have a hash table keyed by the virtual page number of page table entries. So this has actually been used. It's not a bad idea. It's just not the most common thing to do. So instead, we're going to use a tree data structure. So not quite a search tree, because that's not going to give us the properties we want. But we're going to use a tree data structure where the idea is that parts of this tree, which have big holes, we just don't have any space for. So the tree data structure we're using doesn't look like the sort of trees you learned in like 2150, you know, which typically are nice binary, typically are balanced in some way. This is not quite what it looks like. And this is partly because of how we want to access this. So the access needs to be implemented in hardware. So the lookup needs to be really simple to do in hardware. We don't want to do lots of comparisons. That's not that easy to do in hardware, to do like 16 comparisons. We don't want to do, you know, or other calculations. We also don't want to do lots of memory accesses. So if you think of a traditional binary search tree, that's lots of memory accesses. This is not something we want to do in hardware. We went to access memory a couple times because each of those is a lot of work for the hardware. So the scheme we're going to use are what the book calls multi-level page tables. And basically what that looks like is that we'll have a page table which doesn't hold the program pages but holds more page tables, a table of tables. And that table of tables will have entries for chunks of virtual pages. So in this case, each of my page tables contains 256 entries. At my first level, each of these 256 entries points to a table of 256 entries. Those entries are actually the things which point to our actual data. And the nice thing about this scheme is that when I have big holes in my first level table, I just have an invalid entry, so I don't have to represent them. So because I'm not using any virtual page numbers between hex 100 and hex 1FF, I just have an invalid entry in the first level. But I am using some of the virtual page numbers between 0 and 255, so I do have an entry here. And some of these entries, some of these page table entries here are valid. Not necessarily all of them, but some of them. So I need to have that pointer to the second table. So our first level table has entries which look exactly like page table entries, but the physical page number, instead of being where our data is stored, is the page number of the next table. And to keep things simple, we're just going to have all our tables start at the beginning of a physical page. So use the page number, just add zeros to it, because that's where the first entry of the table is going to be. So we have some invalid entries that represent a hole. Otherwise, we have an actual physical page number, which is where the hardware is going to look for the next table. So if we're accessing address hex 10, the hardware is going to say, that's in this range, so I'm going to look in this place next. And it does the same thing for every other address. And you notice that I chose a power of 2 for the size of these ranges, and that's deliberate. That means that we don't actually need to do division or anything like that. We just look at certain part of the bits of our address, and we know which entry in this first level table to use. And generally, you'll find that we'll have divided this up into some power of 2 size, so we can do this. So we can just say, take some part of our address and use that to figure out which entry in this first level table we use. So after we read the first level table, so let's say we're accessing address 0330, we're going to go to this physical page and we're going to look up another page table. So that page table is going to look like the ones we saw before, except it's not necessarily going to start at virtual page number 0, it's going to start wherever the first level page table said it start. Whichever row it's in, that's where it starts. And it doesn't go all the way through memory, it just goes through this chunk, in this case, 256 entries. So if we're accessing page 300, we'll take the start of this second level page table, advanced by 4 entries. And that would be where we'd look. So we figure out which row of this table to go to with the other bits of the address, other bits of the virtual page number, I should say. If we're accessing 303, that's 4 entries back. So we've divided up our virtual page number into 2 pieces, one for each level. We use the first piece to access the first level to figure out what row of the first level. Then we access the table for the second level. We use the second piece to access that, and so on. So So as I said, so we have, we're doing our page table lookup. We have our virtual page number, which now we split into two parts, one per level. And just like we did before, we're going to take a page table base register. We're going to multiply part of the virtual page number by the page table entry size and add the base register. This gets our location of the entry in the first level table. So we're going to read that. We're going to split up the page table entry. We're going to check if it's valid, readable, etc. But now, unlike before, we're not done. We have a physical page number, but it's not the physical page number that we actually want in our address yet. It's the physical page number of the next page table to look at. So we're going to take the next part of our address, use that physical page number to look in that table. Use the physical page number and that part of the virtual address to look in the table. And we have the address of our second page table entry, which in this case is our final one. So then we use that, and we have a physical page number in there, and that's what we actually put in our address. And just like we did before, we copy the page offset from the original virtual address to the physical address. So questions about any of this procedure? So notice that before I talked about we had two memory accesses for every memory access. We've made this worse. Now we have three. So we have our first level page table lookup and our second one. So we have these two lookups, each of which is an extra memory access on top of the real one. We also, have all this happening in our MMU. So the thing I had as the MMU before, it's not just doing one page table lookup, it's doing multiple, so there's more trips back and forth to, in this case, the data or instruction cache. So another way, and the sort of diagram our textbook uses more often, and you might find in, say, the Intel manuals of viewing this, is that we take the page table base register, we use that and the VPN to access a page table entry, which we use to access with the other second part of the VPN, another page table entry, and access the physical page that way. So this is a more compact diagram showing the same information, sort of less about what you do and more about logically where does information flow. So this is, general idea is multi-level page table. So I showed you two levels. The general idea is we're going to split our virtual page number into parts for each level of the table. And the top levels, the page table entries, look exactly like a normal page table entry, but instead of pointing to data, they point to the next page table. And the bottom entry actually points to the destination page number, the thing we're going to use to form the physical address the program is really trying to access. And in the process of doing this, we do all our validity and permission, read, write, kernel, etc. checks at every single level. And a brief note on VPN splitting, since this comes up. As a point of confusion. So the textbook in its diagrams, for some reason, labels the parts of the VPN, VPN1, VPN2, and so on. This gives many people the impression that these are different virtual page numbers, that the address is multiple virtual page numbers. This is not true. They are parts of a virtual page number. The entire thing that's not the page offset in a virtual address is the virtual page number. These things are parts of that. And our textbook should not be labeling them that way. Okay, so let's go through an actual example. So on 32-bit x86, you can have, say, a 32-bit physical address and sometimes a 32-bit virtual address, or 32-bit virtual address and sometimes a 32-bit physical address. We'll use that example. And we have a 2 to the 12 byte page size, that's 4 kilobytes. And typically, 32-bit x86 uses a two-level page table. Each page table at every level is exactly one page long. And we have 4-byte page table entrants. So given this information, how do we split up this virtual address? Remember, we have two parts of the virtual page number and a page offset. So what are each of those? So someone wants to tell me how to start this. Yeah. Okay, so a good thing to start would be to figure out how big is each of these page tables. So we have 4-byte page table entries, and we have, which is 2 to the 2 bytes, and we have 2 to the 12 bytes in a page divided into 2 to the 2 byte page table entries, so that's going to give us 2 to the 10 entries for per page table. So then we have 2 to the 10, that's 1,024 entries in each page table, which means that each VPN part is 10 bits, because we need 10 bits to represent all the 2 to the 10 possibilities. So that means the way that our address gets split up, our virtual address, is that we have VPN part 1 is 10 bits. We have VPN part 2 is 10 bits. And we have the rest, which is 12 bits, is our page offset. And you can see happily that 12 bits is also what 2 to the 12 would give you, so everything checks out. If 32 minus 10 minus 10 disagreed with that, that would be a problem. We have some impossible setup where either I'm lying to you about how many entries are in a page table or about how big the pages are. So that's how it's split up, and then what we need to do is we just need to take this hexadecimal number and line it up with that mapping. So the bottom part is easy because that's hex 6, 7, 8. For the rest, I would write out each hex digit as bits and then divide them up. And I conveniently figured this out earlier. So that's just, I wrote out 1, 2, 3 as binary and split it up. 10 bits, then 10 bits, then the rest is 6, 7, 8 at the end, 12 bits. So any questions about this procedure? Okay. So if you remember last time, we talked about gave an example of translating. So first I'm going to go through an example with one level, and then we'll look at it with two. And going through an example with one level, this is almost what we did last time, but now I don't have a separate page table, because I know where our page tables are really stored. They're stored in memory. So I've said we have a page table base register, which in this case is address 20. And we have a virtual address we want to translate. So we're going to take our virtual address, and to make this easy, I'm going to write it as binary. And I've been told I have 8-byte pages, which means that I have 3 bits of page offset. Everything else is the virtual page number. So we have 110 is our virtual page number, which is 6. So we're going to use that to compute the page table entry address. So I take 6, multiply it times our page table entry size, which is 1 byte, because 3 plus 1 plus 4 is 8 bits, which is 1 byte, and get 0x26, which is this value d6, And then I'm going to decode that as a page table entry. I've said the most significant bits are the physical page number, and then we have a valid bit, which is 1, so it's actually valid. So then I look up that, use that physical page number along with the page offset and the address, which is 0, to actually access memory. And I get the access memory at the same place, and I wrote that wrong. Wow. So this is memory at this address. Is memory at that address, which is here, OXBA. And that's the result of the access. So we can do the same thing for 2 levels. So here, I'm just going to expand this to have an extra level of page tables in front. So I have a 9-bit virtual address, and I'm going to keep my page table size the same. So my 9-bit address, 8-byte pages, page tables are 1 page. So we have 3 entries, so we have 8 entries per page table. So I'm going to do the same sort of thing, but now I have a bigger address and it splits up into more parts. So I take the first part, which is 4, that's the first part of my virtual page number, and I'm going to use the base register to access, in this case, D4. I look it up, I find out it's page table 110 and it's valid. Then I take the second part and use it to access the second level of the page table. So our second page table is 110.00 plus this second part of the VPN, because each page table entry is 1 byte, so I don't need to multiply it by anything. If there were not 1 byte, I would. So I access address 0x36, I get XDB. And when I interpret that as a page table entry, I find out I go back to 3 and access not the thing I have written, but address 31, which is here, which is 0x0A. So these steps make sense. So this is the general procedure, so you can do this by hand. In fact, this is very similar to a homework we will have soon. So given that, let's try this one. So the first step I do is split this virtual address up into our 2 VPN parts and a page offset. So does someone have part of an answer? So what's our first step here? No volunteers? So, run through it. So this is our, so this is the address written out in binary. It's 9 bits, which is why I didn't write out leading zeros. And we have VPN part one. And the page offset. So we're going to use the base register plus this value, which is 3 times 1 byte for page table entry, and we're going to get 0, 1, 2, 3. We're going to get BB. So the PTE is OXBB, and if we write that out, that's 10111011. This part here is the physical page number of that first entry, and this is the valid bit. So it is valid, so keep going. And we got a physical page number of our next page table, so that's at 101000, so that's 18, so it starts right here. And we're going to access that at 7 in, which is going to take us to here. So that's our second PTE, based on the second part, based on V2. So we access there, and we have 4C, the first part of which is 1000. Assuming I didn't make an error, which I did, please tell me. So we have, which is, so 4, 0100, and then 1100, I believe. But this is the, so this is our PPN, and this is our valid bits, and that seems like a problem. So it looks like it's invalid. And that disagrees with my notes, so...
I think it's 1-8 for like the second.
1-8 for the second?
Yeah.
Why is that the base? So we have PPN 101. And our pages are 8 bytes, so we multiply that times 8. So we get the bit pattern 101 and we add 3 zeros. So that should be 1-8. And yeah. Apparently in my notes, in the version I had prepared for the slides, I just can't do math and did not get the right second page number, second page table entry. Yes?
Not
2-8. 2-8? Oh, it is 2-8. Okay, so no, I did put this right in my notes and now I'm here. Okay, so this should be 2-8 because this is 8, and that's a 2, not a 1. 1-0 in binary is not 1. Okay, thank you. So we get 2-8, which means our second page table entry is not there, but it starts, the page table starts here, and this is the page table, and we get F0. So our page table is 1111. It's valid. And the physical page number is all ones, so we combine that with our page offset, 011, and we find out that we're accessing at 3 and B, which is here. And so the actual value we're getting is OXC, is what we'll read. So questions about this? Sorry for second guessing myself. Yeah.
We actually go back to where we put physical address 2-8 and stuff.
Physical address. How we got here?
Once we got to physical address 28, I kind of got lost.
So we got physical address 28. This is where our second level page table is, and. The thing we look up in our second level page table is we use this part of the address, the second part of our virtual page number. So first we use the first part, we go in order in the address and how we're constructing this. First we use the first part to look up the first level, use the second part, until we run out of parts of the virtual page number, then we finally tack on the page offset at the end. So just go through the address in order, piece by piece. And as we do, we're just sort of chasing a pointer through these page tables. So that second part of the second virtual part of the virtual page number is 7. So we advance, add 7 to OX28 to get the location of it. 7 because each page table entry is 1 byte. So next time we'll go through probably another example like this or so, and we'll talk about how we avoid the issue of doing 2, 3 or more memory accesses, which is with more caching.